All right, let's start this. This thing I've just discovered says that its battery is partly down, so if anybody, you probably can't see the light from here, but if anybody notices it going off, I've probably, with luck, got extra batteries I can substitute in. What?
So I'm ready to talk about the case, although I've left the yes. paper on the printer. So
all right, fine. So you want, why don't you talk about a case? Tell us.
Okay. Isn't that if you want to start? Or,
sure. I had other things, but that's one of the things you're supposed to be doing.
Okay. So the case that I want to talk about is United States versus Martin Yon. Martin Yon was indicted under a bootlegging statute, and he challenged it for constitutionality for a couple of different reasons.
Can you explain what a bootlegging statute is for those of us who don't know?
So basically there's a hole in current protection of intellectual property when it comes to bootlegging, in the sense that you have no copyright in the work until it's fixed in a tangible medium. Live performances are usually not fixed, therefore there is no copyright to protect. So
go back a step. You're thinking, assuming that everybody knows the jargon of this field. Bootlegging to me involves alcohol.
We're talking about the recording of a live performance without permission, and then presumably using it, selling it for a profit without permission. So as of the previous copyright law, it's not protected because you cannot have a copyright in a work that's not fixed. Live performances are usually not recorded, therefore they're not fixed. To be considered fixed, it has to be fixed with permission. So there's a famous case where one student was trying to sell the notes of a professor online, and the professor tried to sue the student, and the student claimed, well, they're not fixed. And so the professor tried to claim that another student who was recording classes without permission had thus fixed his lectures and thus allowed him to copyright the lectures. However, the court ruled that because the recordings were without permission, it wasn't a fixation sufficient for copyright law. Therefore, he had no copyright and could not sue the student for selling notes of the class under copyright theory. President Clinton signed the TRIPS agreement, and two of the things in the TRIPS agreement, which is the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, it was part of a conference in Uruguay. Two of the provisions were in regards to trying to eliminate this hole in copyright law. There is a criminal statute and a civil statute. The criminal statute provides that anyone who is knowingly recording a live performing without permission and trying to do it for any sort of commercial gain is in violation of the criminal code and can be subject to up to 5 years in prison or 10 years in prison if it's after their first offense. The civil code was placed under copyright law, which is Section 17 of the United States Code, and said that anyone who's doing it, strict liability, there was no intent requirement, would be subject to the normal copyright remedies. So injunction, you can get damages plus profits. So not only what the copyright holder would have lost in damages, but they're also allowed to take any of your profits above and beyond what their damages would have been, as well as attorney's fees. And if it's willful, then there can be statutory damages, which can be really high. I'm sure you've heard about the RAI cases where they go after them for up to $250,000 per work.
The treble damages?
No, that's treble is usually in a
raised trademarks.
That's usually how you calculate damages when you determine that something is willful in a tort case. That's, the statutory damages are separate from that. That's usually for bad faith or things of that nature. So Martin Yon was indicted for violating this statute, and he wanted to claim that it was unconstitutional because, one, that it violated copyright clause of the United States Constitution, and that copyright requires a fixation and limited time, and the neither statute required any sort of limited time duration to when you could keep someone from selling the bootlegs or from bootlegging. He also argued that it was against his First Amendment rights because there was no fair use exception, and one other thing. He also just argued that it violated the basic tenets of federalism. I found the case particularly interesting in regards to our class for a couple reasons. First, it provides a nice backdrop for the criminal versus tort controversy in terms of which law. And also, I think that it there's whether it violates the copyright clause would be better analyzed from the economic point of view rather than from the legal text point of view, in the sense that, as we sort of talked about earlier when we talked about intellectual property, there's a fight in between how the copyright law says to promote the progress of science and technology that authors or inventors can be granted limited monopolies. Or actually, I think it says granted rights for a limited duration. The concept is that you are giving the public a good by publishing a work. So there is a good that's given to the public, and then the question becomes, are you giving the inventor the grant in exchange for that, or is it an incentive to create more works, an incentive to release the works at all? So there's a basic economic efficiency argument in the sense that what is the point at which that duration of copyright allows for enough incentive to get the works, get as many works as possible out, and at the same time places them.
Do you want as many works as possible out?
You want to,
you know, give a government subsidy of $100 a word, and we'll get lots of novels written.
As many quality works out, in the sense that we're trying to, by trying to promote progress in science, there's science in these.
But you're not thinking like an economist, because you're saying works are a good thing, but we don't say we want to produce as much as possible of any good thing, grain, say. We say something more like we want to produce grain as long as the benefit of an additional bushel of grain is at least as great as the cost of producing it. So somehow, it seems to me, you want to be thinking in terms of not as much as possible, but the optimal amount, which is
right,
around the
well,
same thing. You'll get to that.
I'll try to get to that. I wish I'd written this in much bigger font, so it's easier to read.
Zoom. Any word processor should be able to zoom. You can attach it to this, to the cord if you want, and show it on the screen.
So as the professor just mentioned, they're trying to balance the efficiency of the cost of creating works. And that can be arguably demonstrated in the fact that people are willing to buy works. If you're willing to buy a work, then it has a value to the person who bought it greater than the value that it costs to produce it. I will stay away from the internet argument too much in terms of the cost to distribute becomes nothing. Therefore, you get stuck with only the cost to incentivize the person to produce the work and make it accessible. But back to the bootlegging statute. As it currently, prior to the statute, a artist could protect the concert by recording it. So if the efficiency or if the benefit to the artist was greater than the cost of recording the concert, he would do so. Presumably, that would mean that the benefit to society would be greater than the cost of recording it, in the sense that the artist is going to get a great portion of his benefit from selling that recording, and that recording will only be sold if people value it more than the price that it's fixed for.
Under this legal rule, wouldn't it make sense to record your concert with something like this little gadget where the quality isn't nearly good enough to ever sell it, and all it's doing is just getting it fixed so that other people can't pirate it?
I would argue yes.
Yeah. Because you seem to be assuming that you would record it in order to sell it, whereas it sounds as though you've just given us an explanation in terms of copyright law of why you would record it with no intention of selling it, even if you had no intention of selling it.
So that's cheap.
That's dirt cheap, right?
You cut to the end in the sense that...
Sorry.
That's fine.
Yeah.
This is the big problem that I have with the statute, is I think that the concept of the criminal provision is unnecessary and does no benefit. There's... in the sense that you're penalizing someone for doing what presumably is efficient for society, in the sense that there is a demand for these goods at a...
You're now talking about the recording by the bootlegger, not by the artist.
Recording by the bootlegger.
Got it. Yeah.
There is a demand for this good at higher than his cost to record it, as evidenced by the fact that he records it and profits from it, otherwise he wouldn't do it. We're assuming a rational law-abiding bootlegger for the moment. The moment that the recording is otherwise recorded such that he cannot legally record it, he has no incentive to record it, because if the value of defending it is greater than the cost of prosecuting, which should be relatively low given that the current copyright law allows for attorney's fees and they get damages and they get profits, in theory, a bootlegger who does it without permission and where the recording was recorded would give up all of his profits plus pay any additional damages and have to pay the opposing side's attorney's fees, so it would be at a net loss. So presuming that there is any benefit to the artist in preventing bootlegging, they're already going to be incentivized to record it and to protect their intellectual property that way. So there's no reason to have a criminal statute that otherwise disincentivizes the bootlegger for something that would be economically efficient. Any questions, thoughts?
So
I'm not sure how well I explain that.
So the bootlegger is only punished to the extent that he takes profits away from the original artist?
Well,
under copyright law.
Under copyright law, your possible remedies are injunction, which you would not be able to continue to bootleg that one version. You also get damages. So for example, if you were licensing, let's say you made Red Bull, and you're licensing the Red Bull logo for t-shirts, and I decided the Red Bull logo is cool, I'm going to put it on t-shirts and not pay you anything, and you come after me, you presumably would sue for the damages that you would got, in the sense that what you would have charged me to license it. You can also get my actual profits. So anything that I made that I shouldn't have made based on the fact that I didn't have a license. So in that sense, the bootlegger who is selling a bootlegged recording of a public performance that was otherwise recorded would have no incentive to do so if he believes that the artist has incentive to go after him, because he's going to lose all of his incentive. He's going to have to pay. He's going to give up all of his profits.
And this assumes that when you engage in bootlegging, the chance of your being sued and losing is high. And suppose I wanted to justify the criminal statute, and what I say, and I don't know if it's true or not, is these bootleggers are college kids. They are judgment-proof. So although it's true that if you make profits you might be able to extract them, that you're never going to get most of the damages he owes you, and furthermore, they're going to do it given that this is sort of an informal market, five times out of six, you never catch the guy. So five times out of six, he gets to make a bit of money legging your work. The sixth time, you catch him, and you get a little bit. You can't do very much under civil, so we need criminal in order that the one chance in six probability of going to jail will deter him. Now, your answer might be, we don't want to deter him, but my point is only between civil and criminal, that would seem to be an argument for criminal.
I think that's why that was the rationale behind the two statutes.
In the case you're discussing, what do we know about the defendant?
Neither the district court or the appellate court said anything about the facts of the case, because it was a motion to dismiss the indictment, so there had been nothing other than the fact that...
And you didn't Google and find any news stories about whether he was a college kid or a multimillionaire who made his living bootlegging?
The information I got was not... Google did not come through with a ton of information about Martin Rowan. The implication I got from the articles that I read that was... didn't sound like he was a college kid. It sounded like he was a professional bootlegger.
Uh-huh.
He did not sound like a millionaire, though.
Yeah.
Because it was one of the subsets of Lessig's groups, I think, was the one who ended up doing the defense of this.
Uh-huh, right.
So he wasn't paying his own legal fees, so I don't think he was...
So from your standpoint, why should there be any civil... That is, if your basic argument is that if the artist isn't bothering to record it anyway, then the bootlegging produces net benefits for the world. That seems to be your core argument. So why should there be either civil or criminal statutes? Why not just leave it to copyright law?
To get to some of the policy behind that, I was trying to think of examples. And I think there are a lot of concerts that become famous after... the concert you would not have known that it was going to be in a particularly good performance prior to the actual performance.
Right.
You could say a lot of historical events, anytime something crazy happened in the middle. For example, when Lincoln got shot watching the play, a recording of that might be highly valuable now, but it had no perceived value prior to that. So by disincentivizing people to record it, prior to knowing what the value would be, you've done society a net harm in the sense that even if the value was really little at that time, a bootlegger whose costs are little might be able to do that, and thus the benefits of society would be high. You see that a lot with bands who come out and do their first concert's really big, and people want to go back later. A lot of the Beatles stuff, there's tons of Beatles and Grateful Dead concerts that have become famous because of bootleg versions, not because the artist or the recording company decided to record the...
Are there any of you who would like to reverse it and like to argue for the other side that indeed bootlegging ought to be illegal even when it doesn't violate copyright? Yeah?
Well,
you're having a different question.
That.
That's fine. Say nothing else then.
I was going to say if you're arguing that bootlegging can cause a net benefit, should there be some sort of a penalty on the performer for not recording and disseminating his information in the most efficient way? Because he's not providing a benefit to society that he could otherwise be providing.
So, again, things that I had written down and haven't talked about.
Shouldn't there be a penalty on you for not having set up a lemonade stand outside in this hot weather?
Well, that's how the system works.
It's
different from what he's saying, actually, because an inventor who invents something that doesn't come to the patent office for a certain amount of time loses the rights to his invention.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that would be...
Yeah.
Well, I think that there's... So, are you arguing that the person who records the concert and then does nothing with it, or the person who records the concert and then will only sell it for $100.
I'm saying the person who performs the concert and doesn't record it, they could be providing a greater benefit to society.
But we don't know that because we don't know a priori whether the value of the recording is more or less than its cost. And if it's significantly more than its cost, then the performer has an incentive to record it without any penalty. His penalty is not being able to make money by selling recordings. So why do you need more than that? His argument is that you're filling in a hole where the performer doesn't record it and somebody else does.
So now it's expensive for this to record. Yeah. If it doesn't cost anything to record, then you just say there should be some incentive for everyone to record all the time because more time than about 1,000.
Yeah, but it does cost something, at least if you want it to be good enough to be useful. But I'm wondering if any of you, imagining yourself as the performer, could make a counter-argument on why the bootleggers are really bad guys, not good guys. Anyone want to make that argument or not?
Well, I get one version of
sure.
that argument. Let's say it's my first performance of this band.
Right.
And I don't have the money for whatever the cost is to
yes.
make that first performance.
Yes.
Or first recording. Turns out the concert becomes, we're a really good band. It gets great reviews everywhere. Some bootlegger had recorded it and is selling it for $5
right.
all over the place. We have no right to go after him under current copyright law because we didn't record it.
But would you be better or worse off if he didn't? If because of the law he didn't record it?
Well, let's argue that the reviews came only from people who saw the original performance.
Yep.
And ignoring any potential conflict there. The second concert we decide to record because now we have some buzz and we think that people are
right.
going to want to listen to our album. Our cost of recording is higher than his in the sense that we have, well, so there's two problems. One is the argument that there's a higher cost of recording because of you have to pay a license to the recording venue and whatever union contract that the recording venue does, but ignoring all of that, the band who created it, saying that they could even record it for the same price, is going to make, there's five of us in the band, we're making one-fifth of what the one guy who did it is, and if we try and charge more to compensate for them, there are more of us, people are just going to buy the first concert, not the second concert.
So the basic point, it seems to me, that you would want to make on the other side is that the bootleg is competing with the later recording of a different concert,
yes.
which, since the different concert doesn't trigger the copyright fixed argument for the bootleg, and that you don't want to do that. And you could take the argument a little bit further, because you could say, since the marginal cost of copies is very low, if bootlegging is freely available, take the extreme case, suppose there were no copyright law, the argument would then be, well, 10 people record the damn thing. They compete the price down to the price of burning a CD, and now there's no incentive left to put on the concert in the first place, aside from the tickets, because you can't make any money on it. That would sort of be a version of the argument for copyright law in general, for why you want to monopoly.
Right. I think to some degree there's a monopoly inherent there in the fact that if you don't record the first concert, the cost for the artist is going to be higher in the real world than the cost of the bootlegger.
Uh-huh.
So the artist will never be able to compete on a concert versus concert basis once.
Sounds to me as though the obvious solution is that the performer should talk to the bootlegger in advance.
And
the performer should say, look, you don't have to pay the silly union people, and the site isn't going to know you're recording it. And I will agree not to record it in order that you won't trigger copyright law in exchange for a suitable cut of the revenue you make.
That's exactly what I...
Does that ever happen to you now?
I have not heard of it happening. I would be shocked if it didn't happen, especially with smaller artists.
Uh-huh.
But I know... The startup company that I work for, we did some work with, I'm blanking on the name of the band, Hootie and the Blowfish, and they were recording a bunch of their concerts, and we were making it such that basically the moment the concert finished, it was available online, and there was a deal with Ticketmaster. If you bought tickets to the concert, you got that particular concert for a very cheap price, and by the rest of them at a regular price. And it ended up that a number of the concerts ended up not being recorded, because the cost of, they had to have a union guy standing there watching you record it, and that cost ended up being greater than the amount of revenue that they were getting out of recording these concerts.
Who's the union guy representing?
Every venue that you go to has a union contract, usually, for any large venue. There's Okay. Hooting the Blowfish is a relatively large band. Yeah. They only play relatively large venues, especially with this summer concert tour.
And the reason for this concert is that the union can threaten to do various things that will lower the revenue of the venue if it doesn't sign the contract.
Right.
So the union is related to the venue.
The union's related to the venue. You as an artist can't play at the venue unless you use the union workers at the venue. And if you want to record it, you must have a union worker whose job it is to record it. Now, recording it was literally, there was a box that we connected to the soundboard and recorded it directly in, connected that to the laptop. There was one guy could do it, all he had to do was plug something in, hit a button on the computer, come back to the end of the concert, hit stop, done. But the cost of the union worker having to be there to supervise this guy was greater than the revenue that they were getting from selling the recordings. And given the potential damages that they would face from the venue if they tried to do it without permission in terms of breaking contract law, they weren't going to risk that.
So then you're going to argue that this criminal and civil statute actually prevents desirable arrangements between the performer and the bootlegger to evade the union contract, right?
Yeah.
All right, so it's a reasonable story. All right, other comments on this? All right, let me go on then, so if I can get my computer to wake up. There we are. To continue the stuff we were doing last time. And is that showing up there? Yeah. So we were all finishing up with 18th century English criminal law, with basically privately enforced criminal law. And what are some of the lessons for us? And one of them is the idea of making deterrence a private good. And some of that happens already. If you're a member of the American Automobile Association, I seem to vaguely remember that they'll give you a sticker to put on your car, which basically says, if information leading to the recovery of this car, if stolen, will be rewarded by the American Automobile Association with some amount of money. They used to do that. Maybe they still do it. I don't think I have that decal on my car, although I am a AAA member. But anyway, that's an example. And as I was saying, you have department stores that have "We prosecute shoplifter" signs. So once you think about it, you can see that indeed in the modern world, there's a certain amount of making deterrence a private good. The 18th century English case gives us a particularly striking example in which there essentially were no government employees who were being paid to track down criminals, and nonetheless criminals at least sometimes got tracked down. That if you think about a pure tort system, deterrence as a private good might be a useful way of getting judgment-proof offenders sued. So if you think, for example, about the problem of online crime, you could imagine that if you had only tort and not criminal penalties, you might have sites that were worried about being cracked join some organization which would put a little note on their site which said, by the way, if you do tortious things to this site, we're going to come after you with all of our trained attorneys and sue you for every penny you've got. Might or might not work, but at least it's a possibility. And given, if you imagine a pure tort system in which the people who are judgment-proof then go to jail, or in the English case, got hanged. In the English case, it wasn't literally judgment-proof, although you might try to pay off the victim to get him to drop the charges. But you can see that the combination of private deterrence as an incentive to catch people and then a tort law where if you don't pay the tort damages, you go to jail or something similar might work as a tort-like system to substitute criminal law. The story of the 18th century English also points out some of the tensions between wanting to get enough people punished and being worried about getting too many people punished in the case where they were giving whopping big rewards, and the result were various entrapment, bogus framing people and stuff of that sort. So I think in that sense it's an interesting story. Go on to Shasta County. This is Bob Ellickson, Robert Ellickson at Yale's book, Order Without Law. It's a good title. And it has some sort of weird history, which is that Ronald Coase, in his famous article that you've read, mentions the case of open range, closed range as one case where he argues that as long as transaction costs are low, the actual behavior of farmer and rancher will be the same, whether it's the obligation of the farmer to fence out straying cattle or if the rancher to fence in his cattle so that they don't stray into someone else's field. And somehow Ellickson discovered that Shasta County was a patchwork of open and closed range for historical accident reasons. And he said, great, we've got the experiment. Let's go see if Coase is right. And he went. And sure enough, farmers and there weren't ranchers exaggerates. People who were growing crops and people who had animals, who had cattle, seemed to behave in the same way in open range and closed range. But Ellickson discovered the reason was not negotiation between the parties by which the one person could pay the other one to defense in if that was cheaper. The reason was that the open range, closed range distinction was relevant to the law of the state of California, but the law of the state of California was not relevant to what happened with straying animals in Shasta County. Because in Shasta County, as Ellickson observed, there were strongly held norms of neighborly behavior, informal, non-legal, as it were, system of law. And these were rules of behavior enforced by social sanctions, that if you violated the norms, your neighbors wouldn't like you, and, you know, they wouldn't, you know, feed your cats when you were out of town, or probably your cattle more likely, invite your wife to bridge parties, arrange to have your kid play with their kid. You can imagine a whole lot of things of that sort. And one of the very strong norms was that neighbors don't sue neighbors. And since neighbors don't sue neighbors, the fact that if my cattle stray into your field, I am or I'm not liable doesn't really matter, because being liable doesn't matter if I'm never going to get sued. So that was sort of a neat classic piece of work. It's an interesting book. But then you say, all right, we've got this system, which is sort of a legal system, even though it's sort of a privately enforced legal system. Let's try to understand it. And the norm for straying cattle, basically, are that if my cattle damage your crop, I'm expected to be apologetic, to make some effort to sort of help undo the damage, and to prevent it happening again. And if I don't do that, if it keeps happening, social pressure builds up at various levels, and the extreme case involves a punishment, which again is in violation of California law, so you see cops aren't the only people who can violate the law in the process of enforcing it, because by, according to Ellickson at least, if your cattle keep straying into my crops and damaging it after, you know, the fourth or fifth time, I say, the hell with calling the guy up and complaining, that does no good. I'm going to drive his cattle out of my property, down the road away from his property, and I'll drive him 3 or 4 miles, and I'll go home. Let him try to find his cattle if he can. All right? And you can see that would be a fairly effective deterrent. As far as I know, it's technically illegal. They're his cattle, not my cattle. But it's not very illegal, and it's a real nuisance for him. And hopefully he gets the point at that point and starts keeping an eye on his cattle. But then, sort of as, this is not an Ellickson, but sort of what occurs to me as the economist, wait a minute, isn't this an inefficient punishment? I'm imposing a cost on him. Fine, that's great. But I'm also wasting a couple of hours of my time driving his damn cattle down the road and then walking back home. And I'm wasting more hours of his time. Wouldn't it be better if I had the equivalent of a fine, a nice costless punishment? Well, that's easy. Yes, I have it here. 10 cattle stray on my land, and so I convert one of them into beef in my freezer and then call him up to complain that 9 of his cattle are straying on my land. And the question is, why isn't that the final recourse behavior? And I think we can see in terms of what you said before that there's a pretty clear reason why you don't want a system of norms that lets me do that, and that is that, as Locke, I think, somebody famous said, every man is a biased judge in his own case. And since in this particular private system, the victim is judge and jury, the victim is deciding what punishment he's entitled to impose. Now, for some punishment, that isn't true. If the victim says nobody should invite his wife over to bridge parties because he treated me badly, everybody else in the community gets to decide whether I'm really just a grump and they should ignore me or not. But at least in the case where my punishment is either driving his cattle or slaughtering one of them, I'm my own judge and jury. If I gain by punishing him, then I'm going to have an incentive to be very willing to convict him. Whereas if the only punishment I've got hurts me as much as it hurts you, to use the trite phrase, maybe not as much, but at least hurts me, then I've got an incentive only to use it when I really have pretty good reason to use it, at which point my neighbors, when they happen to notice me driving someone else's cattle down the road, aren't going to say, oops, what's that bastard doing? They're saying, I bet he's got a good reason to go back to the television or whatever they're doing. So I think that gives a sort of a neat example in an entirely different context of my efficiency of inefficient punishment argument, that they are choosing to limit themselves to costly punishments, and that there's a sense in which the argument is the worse your mechanisms are for disciplining the judicial system, as it were, for preventing people from using law enforcement for their own profit, the weaker those controls are, the less willing you are to have efficient punishments, and the more you should limit yourself to costly punishments. So I thought that was sort of an interesting point. So as I say, all three of these seemed to me I got interesting stuff out of. Now, there are some more that aren't in the book because I didn't know about them then, but I thought I'd talk about it a little. And Athens is this very famous, absolutely insane society, roughly Pericles in Athens. Athens, the Athens we associate with lots of famous people, with Plato and Aristotle, historians and Marathon and all the rest of that stuff. And one of the things you discover when you actually start reading about it is that this was this insane so-called democracy in which every official except the generals was elected by lot for a year. So basically, from the adult male citizens, I should say, the Athens in some ways is a rather unattractive society from our standpoint because a sizable part of the population are slaves. Of the ones who aren't slaves, a sizable minority are what are called metics, which are resident aliens, and they are permanently resident aliens. They don't get to be citizens by getting born there, and they have a reduced set of rights vis-a-vis the citizens. And women have pretty seriously reduced set of rights. One of the more extraordinary bits of Athenian law that I came across is if a man dies and his only heir is his daughter, he has no sons or grandsons, his daughter is required to marry the closest male relative outside of the incest restrictions who will have her, whether or not she is already married. If she's already married, she must divorce her husband and marry her uncle, cousin, whatever. And this has something to do with sort of mechanisms for maintaining a family structure and inheritance and making sure somebody will make offerings to the ghosts of the
ancestors. If she doesn't already have kids, right?
If she already has a son, then there's already a male heir, but if she only has a daughter, she's still in trouble. Yeah. So, but that's sort of, it just struck me as a neat example of just how bizarre this seems to us, which is part of why it's fun, of course. And then there are a number of other interesting features. Another one, I don't think I actually have on this note, but I was rather thought was rather cute, is you have a system where if I catch you robbing me, I not only get the stuff back, I get some additional, I don't know what it was, maybe twice or three times the stuff back. Now this raises an obvious problem, because suppose I say, well, I was told by somebody who visited his house that he saw something in his house that belongs to me. I want to search his house. All right? Well, what are we going to worry about? How do you think they solved that problem? These are smart, crazy people. How do they solve that particular problem? Don't have to go that far. I can search your house, but I've got to do it buck naked. Isn't that wonderful? Anyway, it really is quite a lot of fun. They didn't have nudity taboos, as you may already know. So one of the problems, as I say, is that what we would think of as a tort was like our torts, privately prosecuted basically by the victim. What we would think of as a crime was almost always, with a few exceptions, privately prosecuted by any adult male citizen. And his incentive to do that was that normally crimes were punished with large fines, and he got it. 30% or 40% or something like that of the fine. So that again raises the obvious problem of abusive prosecution. So one they had two solutions, but one of the solutions was that if fewer than a fifth of these very large juries, several hundred person juries, if fewer than a fifth voted for conviction, there was a large fine for the prosecutor. That was sufficient evidence that he hadn't really had a case. And I thought that was sort of a cute idea. Then they had another one which was sort of nice, and that was their very straightforward solution to the production of public goods. And it went as follows. If you're one of the richest Athenians, every other year you must produce a public good. So you're a wealthy Athenian, and one day one of these one year chosen by a lot of officials comes up to you and says, you know, you've heard we're planning to send a team to the Olympics this year. Yeah, sure, I hope they do very well. Congratulations, you're the sponsor. Or look at that lovely trireme put out by the deck. This year, you're paying for her. And you're the captain. You can hire a captain if you want, but out of your pocket, not ours. And so how do I get out of it? One way of getting out of it is I can say, yeah, sorry, last year a different official asked me to do a different one, of a different liturgy, a different, I don't know how it connects to our word liturgy, but they called it a liturgy, asked me to do a different liturgy, and I did it, so I'm clear until next year, go away. But the other more interesting way is I say, nah, he didn't do a liturgy this year. He didn't do a liturgy last year. He's richer than me, so therefore I'm not one of the N richest Athenians, because N is the number of liturgies to be done. And then that raises the question of how in this world, without the IRS, without accountants, without bank accounts, where wealth takes many different forms, slaves, land, silver, and so forth, how do I prove you're richer than I am? And the hint is it is the answer invented by a mad economist.
What?
A mad economist made this invention. And I deduce this from the answer. I don't know who invented it. How do I prove you're richer than I am? Any society, but in particular in Athens.
Try and make that person a slave.
That doesn't prove who's rich.
If, presumably, if I only give you all, no, that wouldn't work.
You're thinking in the right direction. How do I prove that you're richer than I am? How do I make you admit you're richer than I am?
Are you getting me to boast about it?
Key to economics is revealed preference. Judge people's by their acts. I say to you, I offer to trade everything I own for everything you own. And when you turn down the offer, you've admitted you're richer than I am. Isn't that wonderful? Anyway, not clear whether it happened. That is, there were presumably various legal devices by which you could try to avoid having to actually make the switch. But that, at least in theory, is how they did it. So, I thought that was neat. Imperial China, another one we look at in the seminar. Big population, small bureaucracy. And I think one of the things that was going on was subcontracting the job of controlling people to other authority structures in the society, of which the extended family was the big one, although there are also trade guilds and things of that sort. So you basically say, the extended family will discipline its members. We will support the head of the extended family in disciplining his members, and we will make it in his interest, make him in some way responsible if things go wrong, to do what we want to do. And as I say here, one of the things that struck me reading the Imperial Chinese stuff is that sort of one of the standard things that I think of is when somebody is describing some horribly oppressive totalitarian system, they say, look, they get children to inform on their parents. In Imperial China, in accusing your parent of a crime the parent was guilty of was a criminal offense. It was a violation of your filial obligation to the parent.
But not a crime that your parent wasn't guilty of?
Also, what weren't guilty of. But even if he's guilty, is my point, that it's a criminal offense. I say even of crimes. I put it in there in the outline more clearly. And I think what's going on, if I read it correctly, is that they are willing to trade off a little bit less control over the parent in order to give the parent more control over the people downstream in the hierarchy, because otherwise, if the parent is doing criminal things, the people, the lower in the family could use the threat of reporting them to get leverage over the parent. That's my guess of what's going on. I could be wrong. Maybe it's just that they believed in their filial piety stuff, but it's always hard to disentangle. So as an economist, I want to think of sort of all rules as having purposes. As a human being, you know, I suspect there probably are cases where you have rules for reasons of historical accident, as it were. So that one sort of strikes me as a plausible reason, quite aside from a religious belief in filial piety, why they had that rule. Another thing you want to do is you want to have as little business for the courts as possible, because the courts are being run by the magistrates. There aren't very many magistrates. The magistrates are highly trained scholar officials, highly trained in poetry and literature, and hopefully at some point they pick up some knowledge of how to actually run a district with 100,000 people in it or whatever it is. And I think part of that was deliberately setting the system up so that you didn't really want to be either plaintiff or defendant. You wanted to stay out of the legal system if possible. Some people would argue that's true of our system too, I should say, but I think they went much further. As I say, you could torture witnesses. But one implication of that is that one way of getting somebody in trouble would be an anonymous accusation in order to get him entangled with the legal system. They got that one covered. It is a criminal offense for a official to read an anonymous accusation. And the first iteration of that rule, it had an exception if the accusation was of treason against the emperor, and the next emperor removed the exception. So again, I mean, I find all this stuff quite a lot of fun in terms of trying to tease out the logic. And I may get it wrong, of course. You know, it's not like I know enough. I don't read the language. Another one we did, as you may know, Carl Llewellyn was quite a famous legal scholar of, I guess, the 1930s. Hubble was an anthropologist. And I found it fun reading the Cheyenne Way, because my guess is, from what little I know about Llewellyn, that politically he and I were on more or less opposite sides, or at least very different sides. But his attitude to the Cheyenne is very much like my attitude to my Icelanders. You know, these are human beings, they're not stupid, they've got a system of doing things that probably makes internal sense, and let's try to understand it instead of just saying, primitive idiots, why don't they have, you know, courts and parliaments and all the stuff they have. And basically, the pattern of life of the Cheyenne was that during the summer, the whole tribe, eventually there was a division between the northern and southern Cheyenne, but initially during the summer, the whole tribe assembled, because during the summer there were buffalo, which provided enough food to support the whole tribe in one place. And during the winter, they split up into bands and wandered around. And at least during the summer, there was a sort of a formal governmental structure, more than I think any of the other Plains Indians. If you look at the descriptions that Llewellyn and Hubble got interviewing a bunch of people, they were basically interviewing people in the 30s who were old enough that they remembered the life before reservation, from the late 19th century situation, and knew stories from before that. And you see a lot of sort of casual violence, but it is very much limited by the fact that killing is a strict liability crime. That at least in theory, and I think there's one exception in the cases they give, but at least in theory, there aren't any excuses, including self-defense. And the reason it's a strict liability crime is magical. That if you have killed another Cheyenne, you smell of death. And associating with you is unlucky. And therefore, sorry about this, we understand he was trying to attack you at the time, but, you know, facts are facts. We're not going to wreck our whole band by having an unlucky person with us, go away. And so the killer was exiled. Exile was nothing like a death sentence because there were other tribes which were not consistently at war with the Cheyenne where he could take refuge. It's clear in the stories that people did sort of move around in that kind of way. But for a period of some years, he is out of the band. And eventually, after some years, he can petition to come back. He can try to bribe people. He can bring gifts when he comes to petition to come back. And especially if people think his action was excusable or if they like him or whatever, they may let him back in at that point. But for the rest of his life, nobody else will ever share his pipe or his bowl. Because he's still got the taint, even though it's weakened enough so that as long as you keep your distance, it's all right. And again, I found that sort of intriguing in part in the way in which you use a religious belief to, I suspect, serve a real practical function. Namely, we don't have very good mechanisms for judging whether a murder is or isn't justified, so we'll just make it a strict liability crime in a society where people have, you know, guns and knives and things, and where they get into fist fights. This is a way of keeping down the level of fist fight. Another example of the same principle in an entirely different society. Years ago, I read a description of Holmgang, which was judicial duels among the Norse. And under at least one of the systems of rules they used, you have two men fighting in a fairly narrow space. There's a cloak spread out on the ground and then a border a certain distance beyond the edges of the cloak. And the duel ends when the first drop of blood hits the cloak. And the person who bleeds loses the law case they're fighting over, unless he dies, in which case he wins. So that's, again, a neat rule for giving you restrained violence. I want to hurt you, but I don't want to kill you, because then I'll lose the land that we're litigating over, whatever the dispute is over. One of the other things you see in the Cheyenne, is sort of quite dramatic cases, is that someone is breaking the rules, the people who catch him do it, smash his stuff, shoot his horses, break it, smash his gun. As long as he is a good Cheyenne and doesn't resist, because he knows he's broken the rules too, the particular context I'm thinking of, there were rules on hunting buffalo, which basically said that nobody went after the buffalo until everybody did. So that it was sort of an organized mass hunt. And it's a little unclear. This may have been functional, because they were afraid of spooking the buffalo herd. I'm not sure. But one of the things that sort of young adult male Cheyennes did to prove, that they weren't wimps, was to try to go kill some buffalo before they were supposed to go buffalo. And there's an anecdote where a couple of them are found doing that, and the people who are in charge of sort of running the buffalo hunt charge down at them, and the guys do nothing to defend themselves, and they shoot their horses, and they smash their guns, and they tear up their blankets, and the guys who defend themselves, they're properly humble and contrite, at which point one of the enforcing groups says, here are these boys out on the prairie without any horses. What are we going to do about it? And one of them says, well, I got an extra horse. I'll give him one of my horses. And here are these boys out on the prairie. Well, I got a spare gun. I'll give him one of my guns. And so they end up, in effect, destroying this stuff, highly inefficient punishment, and then gifting back at least some reasonable equivalent. And somehow, I'm not sure I really understand it, but somehow they are making sure that people are do abide by the norm for their being watched, at least, that they, in a sense, aren't defiant rebels, even though they've tried to shave the edges
of the wheel. Is it because they have some sort of, other attachment to their goods, other than just, having
them? The horses, they might. I wouldn't have thought the other stuff from the descriptions I've seen, but I don't know. So some general issues that seem to me to be raised by these stories, and that when I have enough of the stories, I'll do a book. Not the issues, I'll do a book, but I haven't gotten nearly that far, unfortunately. But I am teaching the course again next year, so I get to learn more. And next year I think I'm going to try to do Jewish law if I can, because I think I've got a source for that. There's old Jewish law, medieval, early pre-medieval. So one of the general issues is, how do you get people prosecuted for breaking the rules, whatever the system is? And the mechanism that sort of comes to me in our mind is police. You have state employees with the job of enforcing rules. Another possibility is a tort-like system where it's that the victim enforces the rule because he's going to get a reward in the form of a damage payment if he does it. And a third possibility is private actors, but who are doing it not for the reward but for deterrence. If you have a system where other people know whether I went after the people who wronged me, then I go after them to give them an incentive not to wrong me. One of the sort of, when you're discussing why things like feud systems work, people say, well, it's because people are vengeful. And they think of vengefulness as an irrational emotion, but it's not an irrational emotion. Then other people knowing that I'm vengeful, meaning if you hurt me, I'll go to a good deal of trouble to hurt you, so they don't hurt me. That's private deterrence. It's just the old-fashioned version of it before they had prosecution associations and things like that. That's hardwired into human beings, because the ones who didn't have human beings, who didn't have some version of it hardwired, had bad things happen to them. What are the mechanisms for enforcement? And I'm talking now not about how you find out who did it and get him convicted, but what you do about it thereafter. Again, state actors is what we're used to. The Icelandic feud is private actors. It's the plaintiff and his buddies who go kill the guy who's been outlawed. In some systems, such as the gypsies, which I haven't discussed, it's some sort of an ostracism, social pressure. To some extent, that's what we're seeing in Shasta County. And one of the more interesting ones is, as a side effect of private action, in the case of reputational enforcement, where what's happening with reputational enforcement is not that the reason I refuse to do business with you after hearing that you swindled three of your clients, it's not that I want to punish you for swindling your clients. As it happens, I didn't like that guy either. It's that I don't want to get swindled myself. So that is a odd kind of penalty, which is a penalty where the people enforcing it aren't acting to penalize, they're acting for their own interest, but nonetheless the result is that bad behavior gets penalized. So it's another possibility. And the point I've made repeatedly, the incentive to enforce, you need enough so that rules get enforced, but not too much. And this then gets us, in our last 20 minutes or so of today, onto the specific issue, which has intrigued me for many years, and I don't know why it
Other people don't seem to be intrigued by it, but I guess they're just used to living in our society, and that's the tort criminal issue. That tort law and criminal law, if you forget about being law students who know all of the details and you're just a man from Mars looking down at human society, you say, same thing, and, you know, there's a difference in the details, but I do something bad to you, you go to law in some fashion, the result is something bad happens to me, good reason for me not to do bad things to you. And that describes, in a general sense, the overall function of tort law and of criminal law. And, you know, tort law may have some insurance functions, but there are an awful lot of better ways of insuring than my having to sue you to show you were negligent so that you'll pay me damages. But the mechanisms are different. And to me, I mean, there are lots of ways you could define the difference, but to me at least, the sort of really central difference is that tort law is a private prosecution system and criminal law is a state prosecution system. So that in tort, the claim belongs to the victim. The victim is the one who is expected to prosecute the claim or hire a lawyer to prosecute the claim. And belongs to means, among other things, that the victim can sell the claim, in our system only to the defendant, but he can settle out of court. And if the claim ends up with a fine, in the tort system we call that fine a damage payment, and it goes to the plaintiff. So in that sense, you really have, as it were, an offense that belongs to the victim. In criminal law, the offense belongs to the state. It is the state that bears the cost of prosecution, that decides whether to prosecute, just as the victim decides whether to sue, the state decides whether to prosecute. They can choose not to prosecute. This is currently becoming an issue over this whole torture business. But under most circumstances, the criminal system is pretty much free to not prosecute people if they don't want to. And if there is a fine, the fine goes to the state. If there is an out-of-court settlement, which we call a plea bargain, the out-of-court settlement is negotiated by an agent of the state. If the out-of-court settlement involves a payoff, de facto, though not de jure, the payoff goes to the state. In some cases, sometimes literally cash. My impression is that some of the things, maybe Milken's case or some of these cases, somebody agrees that he will pay some very large fine in exchange for not going to jail, basically. And de facto, in a lot of the cases, it goes to the state because out-of-court settlements are a way of buying perjured testimony, which is, as far as I can tell, undoubtedly true, but sort of something that nobody openly admits, that, you know, we'll let you off easy. If it just happens that when he was in the cell with you, he confessed to the important crime we're trying to get him for. And it's amazing how often it just happens. I was thinking about this recently. There's an old English television series. I'm just trying to remember the name of it. Somebody of the Bailey. Rumpole of the Bailey. In which the protagonist is essentially a criminal attorney in England. And I read a book of short stories which were basically by the same guy who did the television series but written later, and they're really pretty good. And so I got the DVD of the first two seasons and was watching them while my son nags me to use the treadmill to get some exercise. He does much more of it than I do, but he's right, I ought to do it. And the treadmill is much more tolerable if you could be watching a movie while you're doing it, so I was watching Rumpole. And the particular first case in the series, there is a very strong suspicion, though they haven't said so, that the guy who has grassed on the defendants, that's the English slang for one criminal betraying another, the guy who says that the defendant confessed the crime to him, doesn't like the defendant. These are two criminal families that have been feuding for 30 years or something, and which would make it very unlikely that the defendant really confessed it to the other guy. He wouldn't have talked to him. One suspects, in fact, that the guy who he supposedly confessed to really committed the crime. That's my suspicion, just as the story is unwinding. But one also suspects that the policeman who the guy reported the confession to said, you know, if you happen to have heard anything that will help us with this case, maybe we'll let you off lightly on that case. It's a very common pattern. So anyway, so that's the basic difference. And then the puzzle that struck me a long time ago, really, it's a triple puzzle. First, is there any good reason to have both criminal law and tort law? And nowadays, I can say, I know you don't have to have them both because I've got counterexamples. Maybe there are reasons why it's useful to, but we know that Iceland managed for 300 and some years with only the equivalent of tort law privately enforced, and unless I misunderstood the Imperial Chinese system, they managed, with some changes over time for most of 2,000 years, in a system where you couldn't sue people. You could only report them to the magistrate for being a swindler and then hope the magistrate would make them give you back what they had taken from you. And so the first question is, do you need both? The second question, if you have both of them, is there a good reason why certain things are treated as crimes and certain things are as torts? And the third reason is there a good reason why you have different standards of proof, different requirements of intent, why the systems differ as they do? And, you know, sort of to give away the punchline, I don't really have full answers to any of these questions. I have very fragmentary answers to all of them. And I like to put the question in the version, since I'm much more attracted by the Icelandic system than by the Chinese system, as should we abolish the criminal law? And we know that we could. We know that at least it can be done in some societies. Would a pure expanded tort system to replace criminal law, would it work for us? And if it worked, would it work worse than what we now have? And so that then says, well, what are the problems that would arise if we tried to use a tort-like system to replace criminal law? Well, let's see. One problem is the victim can't afford a lawyer. That's poor victim. One of them is the diffuse injury with many small victims. Now, of course, we handle a lot of those through tort law already. That's what class actions are. But we don't handle them very well, I think most people would say. Judgment-proof offender. And then there's a very clever argument due to Landis and Posner, which purports to show that an efficient private system isn't possible. It's mathematically impossible. I'll get into that very briefly. And so then the question is, can these problems be solved? Can they be solved for some cases, for most cases, for all cases? And part of what's fun of this game is, once you propose a change to the tort system that would solve some problem that made torts unworkable for some category of offense, does that change then raise new problems, which you then have to reveal? So that's why I have this old line somewhere, a doctor discovered a cure for which there was no disease, he caught the cure and died. So you have to think about that. I think that describes our current economic policy as an absence. We're going to die of the cure. So let's run through the problems. Poor victim can't afford to sue. Diffuse victims, it's not worth suing any one victim suing because he's only going to get 15 cents, that being his injury. And he's not going to do it for deterrence because getting somebody to pay 15 cents isn't going to deter. Judgment-proof defendant, that's a problem that if he can't pay, there's no incentive to sue him. And furthermore, if he can't pay, he's not going to get any punishment, so it won't deter him either. That's the basic judgment. Poor victim, the Icelanders figured that one out 1,000 years ago. You make the claim marketable. Diffuse victims, you could either use class action as we now do, or you could have a system of marketable tort claims with middlemen amalgamating large bundles of small claims, and then having the enterprising attorney buy up some bundles and sue. Judgment-proof defendant, we've looked at some possibilities. One of them is tort law backstopped by a system where if he can't pay, he gets locked up and the state pays a bounty to the plaintiff to make up for the fact the plaintiff isn't collecting damages. That would be sort of a simple system, which would be sort of most of the way to a pure tort system, but with the state still backstopping it. You could have one where there's tort with a criminal penalty if you don't pay, and you just say, so people are going to arrange to pay because they don't want to get locked up, and so that'll be enough. And there's the private deterrence aspect, which is partly a solution to judgment-proof defendants. As long as something bad happens to them, it doesn't have to be paying money, it'll deter them from other people committing crimes against you. And you can also imagine a tort where we make it easier to collect on damages. And that under the current legal system, there are various things you can't seize. There are limits to what degree you can garnish somebody's wages. I don't know what they are, seize his residence, and so forth. You could obviously relax those to varying degrees. And the extreme versions would be either penal slavery, which has been used by some societies, or, sorry, buddy, you owe us $50,000. I figure a kidney and a lung will do it. Right? And you, not a very attractive system, and yet, you know, it's not an impossible system. You could imagine milder versions. You only need one kidney anyway, so... Or you could say, well, we're not going to actually take your kidney and your lung now because you're using them, but eventual ownership of your organs is going to forfeit, and when you do die, the plaintiff and not your heirs get to decide whether your organs are sold for transplant and to collect the money for doing so. That would be another intermediate version. The Landis and Posner argument is it was a very cute argument, and this was coming out of their response to the Becker-Sigler article. And they're imagining a system which is really a tort-like system for criminal law, but in which you've got firms that are the intermediaries. So what does the firm do? They're assuming that as in tort law, the right to collect the penalty starts out with the victim. So the firm goes to a bunch of victims and says, we're going to hunt down burglars. That's our business. We will buy from you the right to collect the fine for the guy who burgled you. Tell us all about it. And they then do their best to find burglars, and they collect a fine, and the state sets the amount of the fine. That's sort of the guts of the system they're describing. It's really their implementation of what Becker and Stigler were proposing. And then Landis says, but wait a minute. The fine that's being set by the state is incentives to two different people on two different margins. It's the punishment to the criminal, and it's the reward to the enforcer, because that's what the enforcer collects. Well, we saw some chapters earlier that the efficient criminal system figures out what the optimal penalty is at the optimal probability, because both catching people is costly, punishing them is costly. So it finds the optimal combination. So you could imagine thinking of that as, for those who are mathematically inclined, as saying, here is penalty probability. For a moment, think of penalties as only fines. That's what Landis and Posner did. That led to some mistakes, I think, in their work, but it does make it easier to think about it. Somewhere here is the option. Somewhere there is the best probability punishment. Well, they say, if the fine is low enough, nobody's going to get caught because it's not going to be worth trying to catch people. Since the fine is the reward to the enforcers, as we imagine raising the fine, we're the state setting the right fine. As we raise the fine, the probability is going to go up, and we're in effect tracing a trajectory through probability punishment space. Does that make sense conceptually? Right. This probability is a function of the fine. Higher, saved by pure chance, that line isn't going to run through that point, so we can't get the optimal probability punishment combination. And therefore, they say the private system being suggested is inherently less efficient than a perfectly run public system. Now, that doesn't guarantee it's worse than a real public system, because we don't have a comparable theory of what the incentives of the police are and so forth. But at least it provides sort of a limit to the public system the private one doesn't have. And that was, I thought, a very neat and clever argument. I think I've made it clearer than they made it, because I think they understood about 85% of their argument. But that's the basic argument.
There's something wrong with the...
What's wrong is this thing is coming loose. Thank you. All right now? Yeah. Yes. All right. Here's my solution. This was one of my two JLS articles. And the solution is that the state does not set the fine. The state sets the fine times probability, which is, after all, the real deterrent. That's the average punishment to the criminal. So the state says, if you catch all of the criminals, you can fine them $100 each. Catch half of them, fine them $200 each. Catch a tenth of them, fine them $1,000 each. Now, we realize there's a problem with this, because we're being a little more realistic than Landis and Posner, and actually some of them can't pay a $1,000 fine. So if you catch a tenth of them, you can collect a $1,000 fine from anybody who can pay it, but you're going to have to lock up the other guys in jail for 3 weeks. Because that, we've decided, is the equivalent of a $1,000 fine. And by the way, you, the enforcers, are paying for the jail. So what does that mean? It means that you can think of the outcome of the system as fine paid and fine received. And in the nice, simple case, where you can actually pay $100,
then it's $100, $100, punishment cost is zero. And in that case, the enforcement agency actually gets if P times F. $1,000 case, though, that's rather more unpleasant, because here it's minus $900, supposing a really cheap jail, because he pays $1,000, then we have to pay for the jail. That means that since the legal rule is that we can collect fines paid of $100 per offense we own, all right, that's fixed. If each offense we own, we can collect $100, whether we do it by $1,000 one time in 10 or $100 every time, anything in between that, that's fixed. We're paying to catch people, so the enforcement costs are coming out of our profits, out of our revenues, and we are paying the punishment cost because we're getting a fixed $100 minus the difference between fine paid and fine received, because fine received goes into our pocket, might be negative, and that means the difference between fine paid and fine received is the punishment cost. So that means that punishment cost plus enforcement cost are a subtraction from the firm's revenue. A profit-maximizing firm will pick the probability-punishment combination that minimizes that subtraction, and that's precisely the one that our theory says is optimal because it's minimizing the sum of enforcement plus punishment cost. So that was basically, I've given you a whole article. What?
Aren't you just not going to catch the people who can't pay the fine?
If you knew in advance who they were, but I was not assuming you knew in advance who couldn't pay the fine. And remember, you have to catch enough people. You're obligated to impose that $100. It's not just you're allowed to. Part of the contract when you buy those offenses is that on average you will punish them with a $100 fine.
Okay.
So you can't just... So anyway, there are lots of further complications you can put in. But I've given you the guts of something I was very proud of. It was a nice, simple way in which you just tweak their system just a little bit. Set P times P instead of... Or P times F instead of just F. And suddenly their problem disappears like a soap bubble. Anyway, that was... However, we've still got a problem. And our problem is what I think of as negative price offenses. Suppose that the cost of catching those... That however many I catch, that all of my possible combinations of probability and punishment end up with me losing money. That it will, if I try to catch all of them, I'm going to get $100 from each one, but I'm going to spend $200 catching them. If I try to catch one in 10, not going to cost me as much to catch them, not nearly as much, but most of them can't pay the fine, and I'm going to end up having to pay for jails. Suppose that for all the possible probabilities, my revenue is negative. That's a negative price offense, meaning that I won't pay the victim anything at all for his offense. Indeed, he'd have to pay me to take his offense. So that's a case in which the enforcer would only buy offenses at a negative price. Make sense? Well, that gets us back to deterrence and a private good. That's all right. As long as deterrence can be a private good, I, the potential victim, am willing to sell my offense at a negative price because I'm buying deterrence. So in that case, that's the story where before the crime occurs, I contract with your agency and I say, look, I agree that you agree that if somebody burgles me, you will go after him and will impose $100 average punishment on him, just like the courts say you can. And I agree to pay you $50 a year for your agreement to do that. And most years I don't get burgled and you get $50. Some years I do get burgled and you spend the money on catching. That's back with our private prosecution associations, in effect. So we have thus funded our deterrence as private deterrence, and we still have a working tort-like system, even though it doesn't feel very tort-like because now it's being funded in part for buying deterrence.
You do this because of an option contract, though, right?
I'm not sure. That is to say, once I've signed the contract, the firm is obligated to go after people who burgle me, and I'm obligated to pay them each year until I drop out of the contract. No. So why is it an option? Who's buying an option on what?
So instead of paying like $50 yearly,
yeah.
Say, if I get burgled...
It's not going to work.
I will give you $50 if you go after them.
But do I have to give them $50 to go after them? If I don't have to, I'm not committed.
If it's an option contract, you're committed once they agree to it, so then they can sue you if you don't pay them.
But what if at the
so
point where the in what you're describing,
price.
If at the point when the, but am I agreeing to buy in advance? At the point when the burglary occurs, can I say, I've changed my mind, I'm not going to pay you, you're not going to be after them? Because if so, it doesn't work. I've got to be committed. I've got to tie my hands. Otherwise, I'm always going to wimp out once the burglary occurs because it costs me money, and then there's no deterrence. So I have to, that's why I want to pay in advance, because now I put the sticker on the door which says Customer of Sure Death Incorporated, and now people don't burgle me. But the problem now becomes with negative price, anonymous victim offenses. Namely, if the potential offender doesn't know whether I'm a customer of such an agency, then I can't deter. So you've still got a corner, as it were, which I haven't figured out a way of covering. Namely, the case where both it costs too much to go after him for what you can get, and where you can't deter him because he doesn't know. All right? So as I said, the private system works for a sizable subset of offenses. We don't know how well the public system works for what's left. So, we're out of time at this point. The chapter goes through the rest of this stuff. My guess is that I probably won't finish this Tuesday because I want to do the final chapter and sort of some general summary stuff. But you've read the chapter. If you haven't read the chapter, read the chapter. It seems to me sort of intellectually interesting stuff that people involved with the law ought to want to look at.
Did you see the article about Bank of America and the Paulson threatening them?
I don't think so. What was this?
It came out in the Washington Post today.
This is the question of a bank not wanting to take money and...
Well, so, no, it's beyond that. So, the Cuomo, the AG of New York, released this information today, and the article I found was in the Washington Post, but basically, when...